So tonight we're going to start Ezra, and we will continue on into Nehemiah. One of the commentaries I read said that they were originally a single book and that they got split. And so we will treat them as a single book, just go right through. I've got on the screen behind me a slide of dates. Okay, by the way, if you want a copy of this, you can just email me and I'll email it to you. As you all know, Israel got sent into exile, and that happened during the prophecy time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel. The prophecy was that they were going to be in Babylon for 70 years. And the stated reason for that is that they were not giving the land its sabbatical years. Now, that's only part of it, obviously. The other part of it is that the society had descended into violence, injustice, oppression, every form of idol worship. They were just a mess. Or at least from God's perspective, they were a mess, which is the only perspective that ultimately matters. So in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, when they go into exiles there, it's to fulfill the Sabbath that they weren't giving the land. And of course, you all know that in the Torah, every 7 years, the land is to be given a rest. You know, you can eat what grows by itself, but you can't plant and you can't harvest. They apparently weren't doing that. And as I say, the number of things that they weren't doing were greater than that, but that seems to be the source of 70 years. Jeremiah prophesied that it would be 70 years, and that's in Jeremiah 29:10. And he also wrote a letter to the exiles in Babylon because there were some false prophets who were saying, this is just temporary. And they were advocating rebellion against Babylon and return to the land. And Jeremiah sent a letter to them saying, calm down. You're going to be there for 70 years. God is going to bring you back at the end of 70 years. And in the meantime, get married, build houses, plant orchards and vineyards and so forth, and seek the good of the place where you are, because in the good of Babylon, you yourself will do well. So what we are today in Ezra and Nehemiah is the end of that 70-year period. And I've got some dates here that I will run by you. And for those in internet that can't see and those that listen to the recording later, I'm going to read the thing, although you all can read it for yourselves. So we're starting in the year 606. The pagan emperor was Nebuchadnezzar. The king of Judah was Jehoiakim. And the book of Daniel says that in the third year of Jehoiakim, Daniel and his companions were taken off to Babylon. What was happening there is Nebuchadnezzar was a new king. He was a military commander, very skillful one. And the Battle of Carchemish, and Carchemish, for those of you who don't know your geography, is on the Euphrates River up north of Syria. So it's on the north of the Euphrates River where the Euphrates River takes a bend. And it's a ford place of the Euphrates. There was a battle there between Babylon and Egypt. Pharaoh Necho from Egypt and Nebuchadnezzar from Babylon. Babylon won that battle. And as a result of that, Babylon then came south and besieged Egypt. In that process, they made vassal states of everybody between Carchemish and Egypt, to include Israel. And what they did is they took young noblemen as effectively hostages and sent them back to Babylon. And that was Daniel and that crew. They were taken during that first passage of Nebuchadnezzar through the land. Jerusalem was not attacked and was not destroyed during that time. Nebuchadnezzar was just dealing with Egypt and came down through Israel. And oh, by the way, you guys are going to be a vassal state. And Israel says, oh, okay, because they didn't want to fight with somebody who was chasing the Egyptians. and was clearly much bigger than they were. The comment was, can we say Judah for clarity? When this all happens, the house of Israel has been gone in exile for 125 or 30 years. So the only Hebrews left in the land were the house of Judah, which consisted of Judah, Benjamin, Levi, and probably a bunch of refugees that came down south when the Assyrians took out the northern kingdom. So when I say Israel in this case, it is the nation Israel per se, but it is not all 12 tribes. By the way, I'm getting these dates from two sources. I've got a Bible Knowledge Commentary, which is in my Bible program, Dallas Theological Seminary, and Wikipedia, that great theological reference. So 606 BC is the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim. So when Daniel says, in the third year of Jehoiakim, that's 606 BC. And as I say, Nebuchadnezzar is the emperor. So then, had a little bit of a dust up, and Nebuchadnezzar came back and captured Jerusalem, and he took Jeconiah prisoner. And Jeconiah spent the rest of his life in Babylon. Then under Zedekiah, we had another rebellion. And this time, Nebuchadnezzar had about had it up to here with Hebrews, and he destroyed the place, flattened the temple, and sanded everything off flat. And that happened in 586 BC. So now we fast forward to 538 BC. The Babylonian Empire has been conquered by the Medes and the Persians. So Cyrus the Great is the king of Persia, and he issues an edict. Now, the edict is not specific to the Hebrews. His policy was, I want all of my captive nations to go back to their land. I want them to reestablish worship in their land, and I want them to bless me. This was a general edict for all of the peoples that Nebuchadnezzar had captured. Everybody go home, start practicing your religion, whatever that is. And oh, by the way, as part of that process, I want to be blessed formally by your gods. And in the view of much of the ancient world, gods were territorial. So in order to worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you got to be in the country that's his territory. The same with any of the other pagan gods. So that's the reason for that edict. And that launches the book of Ezra, which we'll start tonight. So under Ezra, the first return in 536, the altar is rebuilt. And notice if you take 606 to 536, you have 70 years. The Babylonian emperor is Cyrus, but the return is under Ezra. And we'll get a list of all the people. We have the names of everybody that came back and so forth. But this is done under Ezra's auspices. He doesn't go back immediately. He'll go back later, but that's where the book of Ezra starts. And notice, as I say, when the altar is complete at 536 BC, you have 70 years. So from the time the exile starts, when Nebuchadnezzar carries away the nobles, to include Daniel, until the rebuilding of the altar is 70 years. So there's your 70-year span. One of the things that happened when the northern kingdom got sanded off by the Assyrians is their policy was, when they conquered a people, move that people somewhere else and backfill with different people. And the idea was that would prevent rebellion because you would detach people from their ancestral land. So if you live in Colorado, for example, and Boulder's your home and you get detached and sent off into Never Never Land, you're all discombobulated. So the Assyrians' policy was to do that. So they took the Hebrews out and scattered them, and they brought in another people group. Well, this other people group was having real trouble acclimating. So they sent to the Assyrians and says, we don't know who the God is here. Send us somebody who can explain who the God is here so that we can worship and keep him out of our hair and things will go well. So the Assyrians grabbed some Levites and brought them in, and the Levites taught the Samaritans, this is who they became, as the Samaritans, they taught them Torah. So the Samaritans worshiped the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob according to the Torah of Moses. In fact, they are in Israel to this day, and they are still an identifiable people group. They still worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they have their own copy of the Torah called the Samaritan Pentateuch. And I don't know what the differences are. I expect there may be some, but you know, they revere Moses the whole nine yards. So as the altar gets rebuilt in 536, the Samaritans show up and say, hey, how about letting us help? We worship the same God you do. You're building a temple. Cool. Can we help you? And the Jews say, buzz off. No, we're not going to accept any help. Well, that just sort of bent things the wrong way. And so the Samaritans and the Persian governor conspired to send a letter back to Persia saying, if you let this city get rebuilt, you're never going to have anything but trouble, and you're going to lose all your possessions west of the Euphrates River. Boy, you don't want to do that. So Darius said, stop. And building stopped. That lasted for about 14 years. That gets started up again, and the temple is completed in 515. So then we have Ahasuerus, and that is the emperor of Persia from the book of Esther. And this number I'm getting from the Dallas Theological Seminary, in 479, Esther became queen of Persia. And then in 444 BC, Artaxerxes issued the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. So the first decree that we're dealing with in the book of Ezra is only the temple. The city is not authorized to be rebuilt. The authority to rebuild the city, put walls back up and so forth, is under the decree of Artaxerxes in 444, and that will kick off the book of Nehemiah. Just as an aside, I have read some commentaries that speculate that Artaxerxes was in fact the son of Esther, because it's 35 years from the time she becomes queen until Artaxerxes issues that decree. So biologically it would work. I just read it somewhere. If you like it, use it. If you don't like it, ignore it. I don't have any real authority behind that. So that's the outline of what we're going to do over the next however many weeks it takes. So I'm now in the book of Ezra, Ezra 1:1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. So Ezra is obviously giving credit to God for stirring up this pagan king. Pagan king doesn't know anything about it. As I said earlier, this decree is to all captive people, not just the Hebrews. Verse 2, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdom of earth, and he has charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. So this is the letter that goes to the Hebrews. So thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Notice, he is the God who is in Jerusalem. Cyrus is a pagan. He is not a believer in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He just says, okay, that's where this God is. Build him a temple there, and as we'll see in a minute, bless me too. Verse 4, and let each survivor, in whatever place he sojourns, be assisted by the men of his place with silver and gold, with goods and with beasts, besides freewill offerings for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. Then rose up the heads of the fathers' houses of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose spirit God had stirred up to go to rebuild the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem. All who were about them aided them with vessels of silver, with gold, with goods, with beasts, and with costly wares, besides all that was freely offered. Cyrus the king also brought out the vessels of the house of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and placed in the house of his gods. You all remember when Nebuchadnezzar looted the place twice. He took basically all the religious stuff out of the temple. And Cyrus's purpose here is to restore worship of the local god. That stuff must be necessary. So if we're going to build that temple and go back and start honoring that god, we got to make sure we got all the right stuff to honor him with. So this isn't necessarily great generosity on his part. It is a practical measure to make sure that the project is successful. In addition to which, you have a large Hebrew community in Babylon. Most of them don't go back. But they have been in Babylon for 70 years. They have prospered. They have done well. So they will also contribute to this project in animals and gold and silver and all that kind of stuff in order for the project to succeed. And as most of you know, up through the Roman conquest of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the major center of Hebrew learning was in Babylon. Many of the Jewish holy books were written in Babylon, and Judah was not considered to be the epicenter of Judaism. Babylon was. The academies in Babylon were much more prominent. So as these people go back, understand that there's a huge contingent of Hebrews remaining in Babylon. Pick it up at 6 again. All who were about them aided them with vessels of silver and with gold, with goods, with beast, and with costly wares, besides all that was freely offered. Verse 7. Cyrus the king also brought out the vessels of the house of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and placed in the house of his gods. Cyrus the king of Persia brought these out in the charge of Mithridath, the treasurer. I'm not sure who Mithridath the treasurer, I think he's Persian, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And I have not found anybody who knows who Sheshbazzar was, other than he is a leader of the return contingent. Verse 9, and this is the number of them, 30 basins of gold, 1,000 basins of silver, 29 censers, 30 bowls of gold, 410 bowls of silver, and 1,000 other vessels. All the vessels of gold and of silver were 5,400. All these did Sheshbazzar bring up when the exiles were brought up from Babylon to Jerusalem. So he's got not only a contingent of exiles, he's also got a whole lot of wealth. And by the way, that journey from Babylon to Jerusalem, over 600 miles. It's a long trek. What will happen later on when Ezra goes is he will get yet again loaded down with wealth. And one of the things he'll say is, I was too embarrassed to ask the king for a cavalry escort because I said my God will watch over us. And it isn't stated here whether they had an armed escort or not. I just don't know the answer to that. But they have got massive amount of wealth that they're transporting a huge distance. This is not the era of the Pax Romana, so I have no idea how safe road travel was then, but it'll come up again when Ezra goes a second time, and he'll specifically say, I'm worried about all this, but I was too embarrassed to ask for an escort. So we're in Ezra 2 now. We have a list of everybody that shows up. And I am not going to read that list. for which I'm sure you're all going to be very grateful, since I wouldn't be able to pronounce half the names anyway. So, chapter 2. Now, these were the people of the province who came up out of the captivity of those exiles whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried captive to Babylonia. They returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his own town. They came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Realiah, Mordecai, Bilsham, Mishpar, Bigvai, Rehum, and Baana, the number of people Israel, and so forth. So now we have a long list of Israelite families and how many people were in each family. They're broken down by tribe. So starting in verse 36, you have priests, and then 40, you have Levites, and then 43, temple servants, sons of Solomon servants, and so forth. Now I want to come down to verse 59, because there's something different there. So we've had a list of all these people by names of their father's house. So in 59, the following were those who came up from Tel Melah, Tel Harasha, Cherub, Adon, and Immer, though they could not prove their father's houses or their descent, whether they belonged to Israel. So what you had is some people that came along who claimed to be Israelites, but they couldn't prove it. The sons of Delaiah, the sons of Tobiah, the sons of Nekoda, also of the sons of the priest, the sons of Habiah, the sons of Hakor, the sons of Barzillai, who had taken a wife from the daughters of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and was called by their name, these sought their registration among those enrolled in the genealogies, but they were not found there. And so they were excluded from the priesthood as unclean. The governor told them they were not to partake of the most holy food until there should be a priest to consult Urim and Tumim. So what you've got are some people whose family stories is were priests, but they can't prove it. And of course, you all know your Torah. There are sacrifices that are eaten by the priest. So sin offerings, for example, get eaten by the priest, and they have to be eaten on the premises of the temple. And they are holy. There are other sacrifices that are eaten by the priest that they get to take home and feed to their family. So we're talking about the stuff that has to be eaten on temple grounds. And what he's saying is, until we can get you certified, you can't eat that stuff. Now, Urim and Tumim, those were carried in the breastplate of the high priest. And they were a way of casting lots, in other words, asking God questions and getting an answer. So what he's saying here is, until we get this thing up and running, we get a priest consecrated, and he can consult Urim and Tumim, you guys can't do the most holy stuff. I'm down to verse 63 in chapter 2. The governor told them that they were not to partake of the most holy food until there should be a priest to consult Urim and Tumim. The whole assembly together was 42,360, besides their male and female servants, of whom there were 7,337, and they had 200 male and female singers. Their horses were 736, their mules were 245, their camels were 435, and their donkeys were 6,720, which is to say most of them walked. And I looked it up one time. I think it's about 600 miles from Jerusalem to Haran, where Laban and his family were. So it's considerably farther around to the capital of the Persian Empire. And it's months journey, especially when you're moving that many people and stuff. Verse 68, some of the heads of families, when they came to the house of the Lord, that is in Jerusalem, made freewill offerings for the house of God to erect it on its site. According to their ability, they gave to the treasury of the work 61,000 derricks of gold, 5,000 minas of silver, and 100 priest garments. A dirach, by the way, is a quarter ounce. So 61,000 quarter ounces of gold, fair amount of gold, especially since gold is heading towards $2,700 an ounce right now. A mina of silver is a pound and a quarter, so more gold than silver. Now the priests, the Levites, and some of the people, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the temple servants lived in their towns, and all the rest in their towns. So what they did is they came back and they repopulated the towns from which they had been expelled under Nebuchadnezzar. And one of the things that you will remember from reading Jeremiah is that as Jerusalem was about to be destroyed and the people all sent into exile, Jeremiah's nephew, I believe, came to and said, I've got a field. Do you want to buy it? And God says, yeah, buy it. So they bought it and sealed the deed in a jar and all that kind of stuff. And the whole point there was, from God's point of view, and he's telling this to Jeremiah, is you guys are going to come back. And the property that you had when you left by family is still going to be yours. So Jeremiah's descendants would still have claim to that field in Anathoth that he bought from his nephew. So the idea then, as these people all come back, that they would go back to their tribal areas is perfectly reasonable. And they would have known where they were. So I'm in chapter 3, and we'll get through probably verse 7. When the seventh month came, and the children of Israel were in the towns, the people gathered as one man to Jerusalem. Then arose Yeshua, the son of Jozadak, with his fellow priest, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, with his kinsmen, and they built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. They set the altar in its place, for fear was on them because of the peoples of the land, and they offered burnt offerings up to the Lord, burnt offerings morning and evening. And they kept the Feast of Booths, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the rule, as each day required. And after that, the regular burnt offerings, the offerings of the new moon, and all the appointed feasts of the Lord, and the offerings of everyone who made a freewill offering to the Lord. From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, but the foundation of the temple was not yet laid. So notice on my chart back there, I have when the altar was complete. So once the altar is complete and they start offering burnt offerings in the appropriate place at the appropriate time, that's when the exile is formally over. At that point, anybody is free to come home. Most people don't, but it's possible. Comment was that they started on the first of the seventh month. So verse 6 again, from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, but the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. So they gave money to the masons and the carpenters, and food, drink, and oil to the Sidonians and the Tyrians to bring cedar trees from Lebanon to the Sea of Joppa, according to the grant that they had from Cyrus, the king of Persia. Now, you all remember the construction of the original temple of Solomon. And what Solomon did when he built the original temple is he had forced laborers who served up in Lebanon for, I believe, a month at a time. I'd have to go back and look, I don't remember. But they would go up there, serve for a month, come home and work their own land. The next crew would go up and they would rotate. And their job was to cut stone and to cut timber to be used for the construction of the temple. So as this second temple is in the process of being built, they're doing exactly the same thing. They're cutting stone and timber up in what is essentially Lebanon now, and they're building timber rafts and floating them down the seacoast to Joppa before they get hauled overland to the temple site. So they would quarry, cut timber and so forth, build rafts. They would put them in the sea about Tyre, or Sidon, you know, both on the coast, float them down, and then haul them overland, which is what Solomon had done to build the original temple. So what they're doing is going through that same process again, because one of the things that Nebuchadnezzar did is he tore the whole thing down so not one stone was left on another. And of course, he would have burned all of the timber. Now, what I don't know, just no idea, is why they didn't reuse some of those stones that were pulled down. And I can speculate on two things, both of which are speculation. One is that they may have gotten broken up. In other words, when they got thrown down, they got broken up and were basically rubble. Or thing two is they may have been considered as defiled. Don't know which of those, or maybe a combination of those, is true. So we'll stop there for the evening, and we'll pick it up at chapter 3, verse 8 next time, and we get into the political intrigue and all that kind of thing. And by the way, if anybody wants a copy of this slide with the timelines and so forth, send me an email and I will send it to you.